Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. You know, there's been so much going on, and one story that we haven't really talked about, but we have been following, has been the R. Kelly trial, which just concluded. And R. Kelly was sentenced, convicted of a good amount of crimes. I wanted to talk to our guest. She's been on our show before, Oronike Odeleye. Did I get it now?
You're pretty close. Oronike Odeleye. You're pretty close.
There we go. She's one of several sisters, Black women, who have been on the case about R. Kelly and his behavior towards Black women in particular in our community for the past 15, damn near 20 years. We have other people that have put movies together, documentaries. We wanted to just, you know, finally get the update and see how you all are feeling around this, because it's been a long path and it's still a lot of work to go just looking at the response. So let's start off with talking about the formation of Mute R. Kelly and what you thought about with the trial that people should know about.
Well, we formed Mute R. Kelly in 2018 after the Savage family was on the news locally here in Atlanta, asking the police to help them get their daughter back. They hadn't seen their daughter or talked to her in a couple of years after she became acquainted with R. Kelly. And at the time, I hadn't really been keeping up with the singer since the, you know, famous trial that had happened some years before. And just hearing about their fight made me kind of Google R. Kelly and what was going on. And when I did some research, I saw that actually since the time that I was 15 years old, every couple of years, young women and their families have been coming forward saying that he had been sexually grooming them, molesting them, raping them, kidnapping them, isolating them from their families, physically and mentally abusing them, and nothing had been done. And I was just incensed. Being in Atlanta, we're the sex trafficking capital of the world, of the nation, it just really hit home that he had moved his child molestation operation to Atlanta, because the legal age of consent here is lower. It's 16 than in most places. He had moved here strategically to be able to continue to commit these crimes. So he not only got off for what we all know he did in the first trial, but he was laughing and thumbing it in our faces by moving to Atlanta to continue to do the same thing. And we're actually talking about 25 years now worth of evidence of sexual abuse against minors. So it just enraged me. And I started a petition really humbly to try to get him off of the radio. That's all I wanted in the beginning, was Atlanta radio cannot afford to support this behavior, knowing what goes on in our city. And from there, Kenyette Tisha Barnes reached out to me. She is a local activist who wanted to help. And from there, we decided to form Mute R. Kelly and to really make it a financial boycott by the Black community of him and his work. And that was really a strategic choice for us, because we understood that what was insulating him from the consequences of his crimes was money. It was money that could hush people up. It was money that could pay an army of lawyers. And it was money that was keeping the people around him from talking, because they had a financial incentive not to do so. So once we were able to start getting the concerts canceled, the radio to stop playing his music, and the money started drying up, that's when you saw the enablers start coming out the woodwork. That's when the feds and the police can go to bodyguards and managers and tour managers and say, hey, we're going to indict you too. They no longer have a reason financially to support this man and to hide his secrets. So they started coming out, and that's where, the meat of this case came from. It was from the people around him finally coming forward to say what they knew and what they saw. So it's been a long road to get here, but we're just so glad that it finally got here for his victims, because they deserve this moment.
Oronike, let me ask you this. When we talk about R. Kelly, and I know your focus and Mute R. Kelly's focus had been on him, and hence the narrative has him as this island onto himself. But having been in this industry for a long time, and you talked about the enablers, what role do you feel that these big corporations that have backed R. Kelly, and I have to bring them up because I've seen, you know, these major radio stations shut down folks for the slightest transgressions, you know, try saying something anti-Semitic in one of these places. Mm-hmm. And we've seen at the highest levels, you get shut down. And many people would say, as you should. There are other groups and other interests that, you know, I've seen it with police. You know, I remember Steve Harvey saying something a long time ago, and getting a phone call. The next thing, he was on air apologizing about police abuse, you mm-hmm. know. So with R. Kelly, I'm looking at all these women, mostly Black women, who had been abused, who were on the radar for people like yourselves and others about what he was doing. Why did they turn the other, you know, turn a blind eye to all this and not say anything? And what was your thoughts about maybe his record label? And even as you pointed out, the radio stations and all these folks in institutions within this ecosystem that supported R. Kelly in spite of the concerns that were expressed.
Well, they were all complicit in his crimes, absolutely. You know, if you've watched Surviving R. Kelly, you'll see a radio exec say they were instructed when the first, I call it rape tape, came out. That girl was 14, so that was not a sex tape. It was a rape tape came out. They were all instructed to go out on the streets of Chicago and buy up as many copies as they could to try to get it off of the streets. And so that it could be hidden so that people wouldn't know. They knew absolutely what it was that he was doing. But they had a financial incentive, as he was, you know, such a hot commodity and making them so much money, to try to protect him, to protect his reputation at the expense of those Black girls. The radio stations absolutely knew what he was doing. One of the hardest conversations I had with the radio station was here locally in Atlanta when I finally got somebody to call me back. And I went through my argument for why I felt that they should stop playing his music. The radio manager said, no, they weren't going to stop playing his music. People wanted to hear it. They were going to keep playing it. And I said, so let me just be clear. Let's go down the line. You agree that, yes, he is a child molester. You saw the video and know that girl to be 14 and she was a child. You know that this is detrimental to the Black community. You know that Atlanta cannot afford to support this in any way, shape, or form. He agreed with me on every point. And I said, so, but you're saying it does not matter enough to you all to risk the money to do something about it. And he said, correct. So, you know, I say this for in a lot of different conversations, wow. But there is no logic in capitalism outside of profit. There is no morality in capitalism outside of profit. There is no doing the right thing in capitalism outside of profit, which is why we attacked his profit center and had to do that for every single venue, organization, or corporation that we wanted to do something. We had to make it about their money, and that was the only way that they were going to take a stance, period. Now, you know, we talk a lot of times about, you know, the LGBTQIA community and you can't say anything about them. But what they're smart in doing is that they will organize a financial boycott of you in a second. They will get their people up in arms and not supporting your business in a second. And Black people, you know, need to use that. And we need to pull that out, especially when it comes to things that affect Black women and Black children. We need to pull that tool out more often and we'll get quicker results.
And I hear you on that. I still can't help but look at the disdain, and I'm going to use that word deliberately, that seems to be directed at Black women. Had this been white girls, this would have been shut down a long time ago. Absolutely. R. Kelly wouldn't have had, it don't matter how much money would have been made, right? It would have been like, nope, sorry, this ain't happening. You know, our girls come first over money. But it seems like the exact opposite, which is why I was looking at all these institutions that are in the ecosystem, where it's like, you know, you, my daughter, my wife, your aunties, our parents or mothers are all expendable when it comes to capitalism and making this money. And that's what seems to be, to me, just as painful as R. Kelly's blatant transgressions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when people try to paint him as, you know, a guy that just likes young girls and, you know, that this is something innocent. Part that point that you just made is often what I think about, in that he was very strategic in who it was that he was targeting, because he knew that nobody, not corporations, not even our own community, really valued them enough to do anything about it. We're not talking about young women who are you know, very developed or shapely or video vixens or who have money or any. I mean, so many of his victims are poor girls from the South Side of Chicago who were just completely enamored with this superstar that paid them any bit of attention, because they were so far outside of the kinds of girls that are usually paid this kind of attention. He did that deliberately. This is a man who had access to all the women of the world. And where was he going to pick up, you know, his victims? He was going to the McDonald's in Chicago. You know, he was going to the mall. He was going to the high school. These girls, you look at a lot of the pictures when they first met him, these are skinny little chicks that look like children. You know, these are dark-skinned girls who often don't get that kind of attention. You know, so he knew exactly what it was that he was doing. He was playing on all of the pathology of our community and the racism of America to shield himself from where he is now, from being in jail.
Many of us saw the documentary, which you were featured in. In fact, you know, nationally, that's how many people got to really know you and your work. Surviving R. Kelly, you know, which Dream Hampton, you know, put together. Mm-hmm. With that being said, what we saw in the documentary was outrageous. You know, that just was like, whoa, what the heck is going on? The trial seemed to double the outrage. I mean, it seemed like the documentary was scratching the surface versus what came out in the trial. What do you think people really need to know that came out in the trial? I don't want to, you know, maybe sensationalize, but were there some searing moments that you had to look and say, you know, this is worse than I thought it was?
For me, having been so entrenched in this, you know, for this long at this point, there was nothing to me that was so salacious that you know, I was like, I can't believe this. I think for a lot of people, it was shocking to discover that his victims were not all female, that he also was sexually abusive to young boys. And I saw that create ripples, you know, on the internet with people and outrage. And you know, I think that people need to realize that these folks get so deep in depravity that anybody can be a target. And so what we know of what he has done is only the tip of the iceberg of what he's actually done. Whenever I'm in Chicago and I'm doing talks about this work, about sexual abuse and child sexual abuse, there are always people in the audience. If they're around my age, if they're between, say, 35 and 50, that has a personal R. Kelly story, that knew someone who was, you know, targeted by this man. They know someone who was in some kind of a sexual relationship with this man. They know, you know, they saw him growing up all the time at their high school. Everybody has an R. Kelly story. So when we look at, you know, the dozens who've come forward, we have to realize that there are dozens upon dozens more, male and female, that have not.
We have, you know, statistics that say 1/3 of the women globally will encounter some sort of sexual assault, which is sad. In many parts of our own community, depending on what part of the country, that figure goes up to 44%. We have police, you know, in Chicago, in Atlanta, right here in Oakland, where I'm at, that have been involved in sex trafficking and rapes and all this. With the R. Kelly situation, two things. One, do you feel that people have developed a certain sensitivity now, that we're moving in a better direction, that people are now aware of the extent of this abuse, that it's on all levels? It's from the R. Kellys to even police officers, you know, government officials, et cetera, et cetera. And are we making moves to stop it? That would be my first question. Second, is there any legislation that you've been a part of, that you've seen being championed as a result of the R. Kelly situation, that would hopefully put things, you know, make it easier for women that are coming up or just people who are being abused that are caught up?
You know, for the first part of your question, yes, I think we definitely are moving toward a society where people understand the gravity of and the enormity of the problem of sexual abuse and that it's at all levels. I don't know that I feel as though we're doing a better job of catching it and prosecuting it before it's been going on for years and years and years. Unfortunately, it still takes dozens upon dozens of victims to come forward for one person to be held accountable. You know, if this were just one person saying that R. Kelly, you know, sexually abused or raped them, I don't know that we'd be here. It's the fact that it's dozens upon dozens. You know, I mean, if we look at the evidence against your Epsteins and your Weinsteins and Bill Cosby and, you know, all of these kinds of folks that, I mean, they've got 20, 30, 40 victims coming forward. And yet, and still, you know, it takes so long to bring them to the mount of accountability. I'd say we still have a lot of work to do. We still have a hard time trusting and believing women. And that's, if we don't get better at that, then we're just gonna be sacrificing generations of women to abuse and condemning them to lives of a lot of mental instability and unhealthy relationships and trauma. So we have to do better. And I just wanna take a quick second to kind of flush out a little bit about what we mean when we say believe women, because I get a lot of pushback on that, like especially from men. They're like, so you're just supposed to believe what she says without evidence. And that isn't necessarily what we mean. What we mean is that when a woman comes forward with her accusations, she is believed to be doing it in earnest, and it is going to be investigated and taken seriously and handled in a professional way. That's right. What we mean. We mean we want a thorough investigation. We want the police to do their job. What often happens is they're not believed, so they're discouraged from filing any kind of a report. And if they do, they are re-traumatized by all the systems that are supposed to be there to help them find justice, and they're dismissed. So that's, you know, what we mean when we say believe. When we may take it seriously, like take those accusations seriously and give them the rigorous investigation that you would any other kind of accusation. In terms of, you know, legislation, I haven't seen too many things that make me very hopeful. And as we see a nation that's doubling down on banning abortion, you know, it makes me very sad, because while we can talk about abortion, you know, in terms of a woman's right to choose or a woman's health, oftentimes abortion is a toolkit within an abused woman's armory that she's able to use to help her get out of a bad situation. So many women are trapped in abusive relationships because of the children that they have. Either financially, they cannot afford to leave their abuser, or the abuser has a strong tie to their children, or they know, even if I am going to leave this situation, I'm tied to this person for the rest of my life legally, because they have a legal right to be in the life of their child. And so that's another way that they can continue to traumatize and abuse me forever. So abortion is an important tool when we try to help women get out of these situations. So when we see legislation like that, it just is discouraging, because it makes it harder for women to liberate themselves from these kinds of harmful situations.
Well, and I guess just to clarify, it seems like in some of these abusive situations, the child is born against their will.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, so you get, you know, that's the anchor. Like, absolutely. You want to have this baby. Yeah. With R. Kelly trying to do that himself in these situations?
I'm not really sure. I know that I have heard from multiple victims that he forced them to have abortions. Some of that, I think, you know, was happening while he was married and having children with his wife. So he doesn't seem, you know, interested in trapping them in that kind of a way. He used more mental and physical abuse to keep these women trapped in these cycles. And shame. He used a lot of shame. I think when people heard about, you know, the letters that he made people write that had false information in them that he would then be able to use against you if you tried to leave him, or if you tried any legal action against him, or some of the shameful things that he would make them do. I know I'm not sure if this was in the trial or earlier on when some of the women talked about him making them eat feces.
Yeah. You
know, shame is a powerful tool to keep people from thinking I can never go back to my family, because now I'm ruined. I'm dirty. I'm you know, a bad person. And so he used a lot of shame and mental and physical abuse.
There's been defenders of R. Kelly not surprisingly, Bill Cosby, who, you know, caused a lot of, you know, disruption in these sorts of conversations, says that he was railroaded. We have people that are bragging, well, I'm going to play his music. I can't separate the music from the man, and, you know, or I can separate the music from his actions, et cetera, et cetera. How do we deal with that? And is this just, you know, the era of just being contrarian just for the sake of it? Is this clout chasing? I'm going to be the rebel, you know, even in the most outrageous situations? Or is this something more deep-seated that really says that we have work to do?
We definitely have work to do. And these have to be continuing conversations in our community. We can't let these be one-offs. This isn't just about R. Kelly, obviously. We have a really big sexual abuse problem within the Black community. And if someone is saying that they're going to continue to support R. Kelly through this, a person that they do not know at all, then they're absolutely going to support their uncle, who they love, when they know he's doing it. They're absolutely going to support their pastor, who, you know, when they know that he's doing it. They're absolutely going to support, you know, the abusers that they know and have actual personal relationships in their real life. So we need to take these, you know, these comments as serious when we hear them coming from our friends and loved ones, because that means that they can be knowingly or unknowingly an enabler of this type of behavior in their own community. I tell men all the time, you look to your left, you look to your right, you look to your front, you look to your back. If there are women all around you, somebody in that group has been sexually abused. You know what I mean? Like you can't throw a stone in the Black community and not hit a Black woman in particular who has been sexually abused. And if she has not shared that truth with you, if you had no idea, that means she didn't trust you enough with that truth. So you need to think about why that may be so. And it may be so because she saw you defending a sexual abuser on your Facebook. So she would never tell you, you know, that the coach you love so much sexually abused her. You know, so we have to keep having these conversations, and I understand where it comes from. I, you know, growing up, came from a very strict household. We weren't allowed to watch TV during the school week. The only thing we could watch was the Bill Cosby show on Thursday nights. And then when A Different World came out, we could watch that on Fridays. That's it. That's all the TV I saw during the week. So I also am emotionally tied to these people. I understand how people can think about R. Kelly and think about the soundtrack of their own life. You know, they're thinking about their own wedding. They're thinking about their own graduations and the good feelings that brings. But we can't let that blind us to the real harm these people have done in our community. And the fact that they were going to continue to do that harm until they were dead in the ground if we hadn't stopped them. People right. always want to talk about, you know, redemption and forgiveness. None of these people have asked for forgiveness. They have not sought redemption. They have not stood up and apologize for their actions and made amends. You know, so we have to be more critical about who it is that we support. Like a good friend of mine is always telling me, he never understands support. He said, this ain't no Medgar Evers. Like, we're not talking about, you know, brothers who were out here doing good for the community. R. Kelly ain't starting no schools. What are we supporting here? All we're supporting really is abuse.
Real talk. You know, lastly, you know, the white abuser versus Black abuser. We hear this a lot. Well, you know, why are they going after him? Why are they saying, seems like RNAK, it's all the Black folks. Bill Cosby's in jail and R. Kelly's being boycotted. What about all these, the Epsteins and the Woody Allens and Harvey Weinsteins and the coaches, you know, that, you know, from Penn State and the gymnastics, why aren't we boycotting? You get that sort of thing. How do we either contextualize it? Do you put the R. Kelly situation in the same boat in the larger rubric of these people, or are these separate things, or is there any validity to this argument?
Well, absolutely. There's always validity to people calling out some of the structural racism in, you know, prosecution. Absolutely. There's some validity there. But I also remind people, Harvey Weinstein's in jail. Epstein was in jail when he, quote unquote, killed himself. You know, I mean, so let's not act like they were not getting prosecuted. But my bottom line is that I wake up in the morning and I put my energy and my resources and my best self toward the betterment of the Black community. Slavery is over. It's not my job to clean up white folks' houses. Yes, we can boycott Harvey Weinstein. Yes, I can get a bunch of women out to picket, you know, Donald Trump for his sexual abuse. But why would I do that when my own house needs work? You know what I mean? Like you're supposed to clean up your own house before you go worrying about somebody else's. So all the people that want me to put on my maid uniform and go out here and clean up the streets for white women, I say that them days are over. We are liberated. I'm cleaning my own house. I want to make sure that the streets are safe for me and my sisters and the women of my community. And I think that they need to be focused on the same. We do too much worrying about what white folks are doing. You know, when we're talking about things that are just, you know, in the inequalities, and absolutely. But when Black women are standing up and saying, hey, we need you all, the police, to get this Black man off of our Black streets because he's abusing our Black women, that's not the time to be talking about white folks. That's actually when we're asking the system to do what it was actually supposed to be doing. And that is giving justice to all. And when we stand up and say we want justice over here, we can't both be mad when we don't get it and when we do get it. You know, so that's just my thing. It's like, I'm not white folks' maid, child. White women can organize themselves just fine to do the things they need to do for their community. I'm about this Black work. I wake up in the morning. I got many, many jobs and other stuff to do. If I got an extra minute of my day to help the Black community be better and safer for us all, that's what I'm going to spend my energy on.
Right. And as I explained to somebody, even if Harvey Weinstein's free, are you saying you want R. Kelly to be free? Right. Are you saying that he's off the hook? You know, but yeah, it's about holding him accountable and people like him accountable. Last question for you. What should we be doing moving forward as a community, you know, as Black women, as Black men? You know, do we have different roles that we should be playing moving forward so we don't have the R. Kelly's, or we diminish the R. Kelly's? And again, I want to just remind people, R. Kelly's the visible individual. He's the superstar. So it's easy to look at him. But as you pointed out, there's an uncle, there's a pastor, there's a coach, there's all sorts of people who don't have that visibility that are wreaking havoc in our communities. And I think whether you're in Chicago, Atlanta, or here in Oakland, we can just walk down some of these streets and see, you know, young Black girls, not women, but girls, you know, dressed scantily in the winter, you know, working for somebody to earn money. So that abuse is right down the street from us, literally. So what should we be doing moving forward?
I think it's really important for us to be taking these conversations into our living rooms with our families, into schools, into our churches and community, and really be talking about them in a holistic way, and educating ourselves about them. You know, every conversation ain't good conversation. Lots of conversations happen in barbershops that really don't need to be happening. They pass a lot of misinformation around, and dealing in stereotypes and pathology. But I would really encourage people who like want to protect themselves, their families, their children from sexual abuse, really need to be doing some reading about this topic and understanding ways in which we can raise body positive children that understand how to protect themselves from this as they grow up. Parents can't be everywhere all the time. We need to be having men who really understand the depth of what grooming looks like, you know, of what manipulation looks like, of what consent is and what it looks like, so that they can be talking to other brothers, they can be talking to their sons about these things. You know, we really need to be focusing on education and then spreading that education throughout our community. Because this idea about, you know, the gold digger, the fast girl, the, you know, the people out here trying to trap and bring down the man, those are all stereotypes, many of them which have their roots in slavery as the ways that white enslavers were able to justify their abuse against Black women. Yeah. And those stereotypes about Black women being fast, being over-sexualized, you know, being liars, being untrustworthy, then permeated our community and are still here. We're spouting rhetoric from white enslavers as a reason why we do not believe and support our sisters. You know, so we need to do a lot of education and reading about this stuff so that we can have better and higher level conversations and start to turn some of this stuff around. Because when you look at the actual statistics of sexual abuse for Black girls and Black boys in our community, it's shameful.
Absolutely.
And it should really move us all to action.
Do we know what grooming is? And are women and mothers part of this grooming process?
Absolutely. Everybody is a part of a grooming process. And for people who don't know what grooming is, it's kind of a slow manipulation that helps an abuser to normalize the abuse that they're inflicting on you or a loved one. So for instance, you know, and it's real controversial whether or not, you know, people feel like Michael Jackson was a sexual abuser or not. But when I was, you know, looking at the documentary and looking at the trial, what struck me was his grooming of the family to make it of the families of these boys and the kids who were spending the night to normalize him sleeping in the bed with them. So we all know that none of us would allow a child to sleep in our child to sleep in a bed with a stranger. But slowly over time, if you're talking to this person and they're calling you on the phone and they're seeming interested in your life, they're making themselves look harmless in your eyes. They're grooming what you know to be unnatural behavior. And so this is a lot of times what abusers do. They groom the families. Then, you know, R. Kelly not only sexually abused his victims, but, you know, he hired some of their families in his band and in his entourage. You know, this is a form of grooming. This is a way to make all of this normal. We're all a family. You know, everything is cool. So that the people around you start to question their own reality. Like, this seems weird. But on the other hand, you know, they've been groomed to think it's not. And so, yes, yeah, so women absolutely are a part of that. Some of these mothers absolutely were a part of that grooming. You know, and so when people don't extend them grace, we'd be like, well, what about the parents? What about this? You know, that's a tricky thing there, because they were groomed, they were manipulated, they were brainwashed in some of the same ways that their children were, because that's how abusers operate.
Right. And as you said, it becomes normalized. Arunaki Odelay, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Mute R. Kelly is the organization that you co-founded, and you all put in the work and got somebody off the street and got justice for, you know, I don't know how many dozens of people he, you know, impacted. But I guess it's a good day in terms of that. And hopefully people are able to take these lessons and apply it and, you know, and really be proactive in shutting down some of the abuse that is run rampant and unchecked in various parts of our community. Any last comments, or can people get a hold of you?
Well, they can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and our website, muterkelly.com, if they want to, you know, keep up with what's going on and get involved. But I would just like to, you know, parrot what it is that you said. We really hope that this conversation doesn't stop in people's homes with R. Kelly, but that they're really sitting down and having conversations with their kids, with their family, you know, in their churches about sexual abuse and how they can be allies, how they can help to protect the people around them, how they can stop any abuse that they see going on. So we really hope that people, you know, take this, you know, as a wake up call. Like, you know, we can't continue to let this kind of behavior go on for decades and decades and decades and ruin dozens upon dozens of lives. We've got to all step up right now, you know, and become activists and justice warriors in our own lives and in our own homes.
Real talk. We want to thank you. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio, folks.